The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey everybody, I'm Mark Lamont Hill. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books, I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. And sometimes I hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about the greatest books of all time. And today, I am joined by a brilliant scholar and a wonderful writer. Her name is Anthea Butler. She's the Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And she has written a wonderful book called White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. She joins us now. Anthea, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, always. Now, on this show, we always start with the coffee before we get to the books. If we were in person, I would be making your favorite coffee or tea for you. But I got to ask you, as a writer, is coffee part of your process? Do you drink coffee?
I do. But here's the kicker. I drink decaf. I know that's terrible, right?
Decaf!
I know, right? Because I can't handle all the caffeine, but I love decaf coffee. I usually have hazelnut in it, a little bit of cream. I'm not so much of a latte person because of that, but you know, I would say, you know, if I'm really desperate, if I'm overseas, I'll have an espresso that's caffeinated because I need to stay up.
I'm about to say, I'm gonna send you through the roof if you do drink decaf all the time.
But since I haven't been anywhere in like over a year because pandemic, you know.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's been decaf land for me over here.
Well, if you've been decaffeinated for 2 years, don't drink no espresso no time soon, because you might write a whole book in 2 days.
probably. But sometimes I need to do that, right?
I hear that. Well, let's talk about this book, White Evangelical Racism. I know you've been working on this book for a long time. First of all, what prompted you to write this book?
Most people are going to think I'm going to say Trump, but it's not that. It's really not that. This is something I've been thinking about for a long time. But what probably prompted it was I got tired of hearing people talk about, why did evangelicals like Donald Trump? And I was like, y'all need to understand that evangelicals have been racist for a long time. And I had my little evangelical stint, which we could talk about, or I talk about in the book, as I went to evangelical seminary. And I think what's important about this is that I got really frustrated with that kind of conversation. I got frustrated with the ways in which the press deals with evangelicalism. I got frustrated with evangelical writers like Michael Gerson and Peter Wenner, who write about evangelicalism and wring their hands all the time because they just don't understand about Trump. And I'm like, you understand, y'all racist. And there's a sense in which the press, you know, and I say this not as though I'm not part of that, but I write. So I need to say it this way. I think that people hear the word evangelical and they automatically think white. And
yes.
They have to ask themselves, why do they think that? And what has been constructed in order for you to think that? And secondarily, why do you not think that they're not racist?
Exactly. Which is an important question to ask. I want to start by unpacking what evangelical is for people, because in the Black church, if I hear somebody say they're an evangelist, I tend to think of somebody that preaches and ain't got no church and travels around.
Yeah.
That's my mind. When I think about it in the white tradition, I think of Billy Graham, who you get into in the book. I think about the big stadiums, but I think more about maybe in the literal sense of the gospel.
Yes.
But there's a political thing going on here that you talk about as well.
Yeah, there's a political thing. So, you know, where you think evangelical, evangelion, the gospel, right, in Greek. But the political thing that I'm talking about is evangelicals as a political movement and as a political religious movement. And I think that's really important because the ways in which people have tried to construct this and the ways in which evangelicals try to elide their political power is to say, oh, we're just a bunch of religious people who have moral things and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, y'all about getting power. And you use morality to get that power. And so it's this kind of morphing into what was in the 19th century, a religious movement, some of which was about abolition, some of it was about slavery. But more importantly, it's about a religious political movement in the 20th and 21st century that has amassed a ton of political power and a lot of money and a lot of clout in America.
How do they morph from the group that is preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, however they imagine it, into this group that has become about amassing power and electing folk like Donald Trump? who don't even pretend, or maybe slightly pretends, to read the Bible.
Yeah, slightly, for 2 Corinthians, right?
Right.
2 Corinthians, not 2 Corinthians.
2.
You know, there's a lot to get us there, but I want to keep it, you know, on a level for making it simple and grasp. It basically is Billy Graham, because Billy Graham marries his evangelicalism to the presidency. And if we think about this, he starts off in 1952. This is the week we're taping this, where they usually have the prayer breakfast in D.C. all the time.
Yeah.
One of the things about this prayer breakfast he did was he starts this off by asking for permission to preach at the Capitol, that same Capitol that gets taken over by insurrectionists on January 6th, right? Mm-hmm. And he preaches a sermon out there, and that's how he begins to insinuate himself with the presidency. So from Eisenhower forward, he tries to make himself friends with presidents, you know, to put this moral sort of way in which he can walk his way into the White House and say certain things. And that culminates with Richard Nixon, of course, and the ways in which he, you know, his relationship with Richard Nixon becomes a very important part of all of this. But I think the other way we need to think about this is not just with Billy Graham, but the ways in which evangelicals put together these organizations that became lobbying organizations. And this is where it gets slick, where we start to talk about things like Focus on the Family and Family Research Council and American Family Association. These organizations that start off in the 70s have a tremendous lot of power, and they have money behind them. And ostensibly, they're about focusing on the family and taking care of your kids and all this. But it's not
really. Which sounds harmless to the average American.
It's harmless, yes, it's harmless. But this is not harmless. These are, you know, multi-million dollar organizations that raise money off of their people and actually every day send you out an email about what they're advocating for in Congress, in the Senate, and for the Supreme Court. So Family Research Council, they were really instrumental in thinking about the ways in which, you know, it looked good for Amy Coney Barrett to be here on the Supreme Court. This is who we want. We want Donald Trump because of X. So we have to understand that these organizations that evangelicals run are part of this political arm of the Republican Party that happens in the post-1960s, the 70s, 80s, and beyond. And I think that's actually one of the important things that should not be forgotten in the midst of all this, that while people think about this as religion, it's really about religion and politics.
And at times they will trade or sacrifice the religion for the politics.
Absolutely.
There's no religious argument for making Donald Trump president. I mean, I guess
none.
Unless you argue that there's some grander plan. You have to be reaching, though.
They reach. Yeah, you got to be reaching, because, you know, guess what evangelicals called him? They called him King Cyrus. They said that he was like a biblical figure. You know, it didn't matter that he was grabbing women by the pee or none of this stuff that he'd done. It didn't matter he was married 3 times. It used to be, for old school evangelicals, you know, just being divorced would disqualify you.
Right.
Exactly, right? But let's go back a little bit. Let's use somebody to compare Donald Trump to. Ronald Reagan was divorced once. They got over that real quick. So why wouldn't they get over Donald Trump being married 3 times and getting divorces? Why would they not get over him paying off a porn star? Because it's not about the religious piece for the person that leads them. It's about power. And they saw Donald Trump as somebody who could redeem the losses that they had. The biggest loss that they had with same-sex marriage. When Obergefell happened, when that case went through the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage became the law of the land, you can best believe that evangelicals sat down and said, we got to fix this. Mm. And so there's lots of different political organizations that are working with the religious organizations in order to regain that power. And Donald Trump had set himself up very well to do that, because he basically was, you know, saying the same stuff Franklin Graham was back in 2012. People forget that he was big on birtherism. He was doing birtherism before everybody else was doing birtherism. Mm. And so when you start to pair your messages alongside the religious message, it's very easy for people to accept that and accept him as being a moral leader, even though we know he's not.
One of the things that evangelicalism seems to do and has done consistently is link the fate of the nation to their particular faith call, right? So the sky is falling kind of narratives, right? Mm-hmm. All religions do it. Nation of Islam does it. Everybody does it, right? The world is going to hell, and the only thing that can save us is X. And if we do X, then we have a shot. Billy Graham kind of emerges out of this, your book teaches us, and says that really the fate of America comes through Christ.
Yes, yes.
How does that become such an effective message? And also, can you help us think through how that's linked to issues of race?
Yeah. Well, see, first of all, Billy Graham is a Christian nationalist, okay? Because the fate of the nation for him is America is the place where Christianity is happening. It's not the place where Christianity is born, but it's the place where it's going to end. And it's the only place that's standing against, in his particular time period, against communism, all right? So you should hear him talk about communism a lot. But for the Black folks listening, for people who understand this, communism is not just about the USSR. What communism is about during this time period is also coming against the civil rights movement. So where King gets called a communist, if you hear Billy Graham talk about communism, you also hear him talking about the civil rights movement, how this is going to take down the country. So it's a dual message, but that people don't hear this. If you listen, you know, if I play Billy Graham in the classroom, people think, oh, he's just talking about communism. I'm like, It's also about how the rest of these evangelicals are thinking about communism is also supporting the rights of civil rights and equality. And they don't want equality, okay? So Billy Graham is really integral to that sort of message. But the other part of this is about Christian nationalism, which we have, or what we could call sort of the progression from Americanism to American exceptionalism to make America great again, okay? So when we got Billy Graham in the 1950s, it's a sense of Americanism. America is a great nation, all of this. Then you hear, you know, this talk from the George Bush administration, daddy and son, about American exceptionalism. Sarah Palin says this a lot in the 2008 election with McCain. But then what Donald Trump does, which is actually really smart, is he says, make America great again, because guess what? America can't be great if it had a Black president. So this resonates to those evangelicals' ears again. And it also resonates to the sense in which evangelicals believe that the nation is always on decline if they're not in power. So when Donald Trump said, make America great again, and in his inauguration speech, he says, American carnage, that just fits right in with the whole worldview about evangelicals thinking that everything is going to hell in a handbasket unless we come back to our Christian roots, which is what all of these people like to sell and spend a lot of money on to make happen.
So, you know, there are going to be people listening to this that say, all right, but y'all are still drawing connections, right? Like you're saying evangelical being against communism is also being against civil rights. That's kind of a draw. Make America great. But these are all sort of connections that one could dispute. I happen to agree with your connections, but in the book, you do something else. You also show the kind of direct connection between evangelicalism and racism. This isn't just the kind of abstract rhetorical games. This is about the project of slavery. This is about Jim Crow. This is about the actual establishment of American apartheid. The evangelicals, some evangelicals, played a key role in. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I think what we need to think about is I got to take you back a little bit so we can talk about this racist piece, okay? Here's the thing. Evangelicals like to tell a story about themselves. We are, you know, we were abolitionists. We were this, we were that. But the role of evangelicalism begins in slavery. Christian slaveholders, or what Reverend Barber calls slaveholding Christianity, right? But we have to understand that the justifications for slavery are in the Bible. And they're evangelical justifications, whether we talk about the curse of Ham or polygenesis and all this other stuff that I outline in the book. This is where it starts. So you already don't think that Black people are part of God's creation.
Right.
You think that they are worthy to be enslaved. And so once you lose a civil war, what do you have to do? You got to figure out a way to keep Black people underneath your feet. How do you do that? The religion of the lost cause. So all these fights about Confederate statues coming down and everything, that's what we're playing out the religion of the lost cause today. And this is really important because this is the spot in which in Reconstruction and Redemption that all of this begins to coalesce about how they put together the white family, how they vilify Black people, how they start to talk about law and order. And this is really important because the patty rollers and all of them people that they're, this is all Christian back in the 19th century. So it's no surprise that in the 21st century, evangelicals are talking about the thin blue line and Blue Lives Matter and all this stuff, because that's how they've been taught in church to think about these things, okay? So it's important to really understand that this racism and racism against Black people in particular, but also in this way in which in the 20th century, when immigration happens, that these kinds of racist attitudes happen, are about slavery. They're about, you know, Reconstruction and Redemption. They're about missionary movements that say that Black people are not real human beings. And the only way that they're going to get to being like human beings is to receive Jesus Christ into their lives. The only way that they can see themselves as being, you know, close to being with white people is to, you know, push away from the civil rights movement or to vote Republican. So when you see all these black conservatives that get together with the Republicans right now, you know, like Alveda King and others, you got to understand that they have bought this in wholesale and they have taken in this racism that it started in the 19th century. They have ingested it. And in the ways in which they talk to other black people about this makes it important for us to see how they act as agents to bring black people into this white construction of thinking about white men, religious men are the ones who should be in power and everybody else being underneath them.
What about the role of colorblindness, though? Because for this conversation about race and explicitly sort of invoking it, there's also a way that from Jerry Falwell forward, or maybe even before, there's also this conversation about colorblindness. And that yes. becomes another piece of the evangelical racial project, no? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So when you see that the gains of the civil rights movement are happening in the late 60s, you begin to see a shift for evangelicals and they begin to put people on stage. And one of the stories I tell is about Billy Graham and Ethel Waters. And that mm-hmm. that is just a painful story for me to write, because when you look at that video of her, you know, sort of pretending this kind of, you know, Christian blackness is what I call it, is really hard because it's like, dang, I don't know, this don't look right to me. But it resonates for white people because this is the role in which they want to see black people in as this sort of docile Christian person. But if we think about, you know, the 700 Club where Pat Robertson has been, Ben Kinchlow and all these other folks on it, I call it the evangelical black friend syndrome. We need black people to prop us up so that we don't look like we racist. And we need to get black people who are going to parrot these same kind of beliefs that we have in order to strengthen our position in terms of leadership. So this happens with Rosie Grier. It happens with so many people that we talk about that, you know, that I'm showing you in the book. But the thing about the color blindness is that they say that we don't see color. Whenever you hear evangelical or a religious leader say, we don't see color, I'm telling you that they see white, because right. that is the operational color culturally that they need to fall into. So this whole idea of color blindness alongside all the racial reconciliation pantomimes that I call them, or, you know, productions of the 1990s and beyond that Southern Baptists and others keep engaging in, this is not about a real sharing of power. This is not about racial reconciliation. It's about racial quietude. In other words, we want you to stop talking about race. So we're going to do this little play about racial reconciliation in the hopes that this stuff is going to shut up and we can move on and do what we need to do.
You make a case at the beginning of the book, actually, that you weave throughout, which is hella provocative. You said racism is a feature mm-hmm. of American evangelicalism, not a bug, which is an interesting argument. The same argument many of us make around policing. We make yeah. it around, you know, is it, at least in the abstract, is it possible mm-hmm. to have an evangelical religious project and not be racist? Is it only unavoidably racist because of the context in which it emerges, or is there something inherently racist about it as such?
I would say that there's some things that are inherently racist about it, because depending on the theological background of what they think that evangelicalism is, the history of some particular churches. So if you're Southern Baptist, racism is baked into the very beginning of the Southern Baptist church because they break up with Northern Baptist because of slavery. I say it's baked in because it's all throughout the history, and it's the history that they have not wanted to look at themselves about. So whether we're talking theologically, we're talking culturally, it's like, how have they dealt with other cultures, whether it's been the missionary activity, all of that. I mean, even in stuff about singing, you don't have Maranatha singers or Hillsong or all the rest of these little frou-frou-y songs that I can't stand. And I hate to say that, but that's me. You don't have all of that. And you also don't have, and I think this is really important to talk about, the sexuality piece is hugely important, because the ways in which the family gets constructed, the value of virginity, you know, and purity, we see this in the 19th century with the construction of white womanhood, you know, and even in the slave during slavery and post-slavery and Reconstruction and Redemption, about how that gets centered around family life and babies and all of this other stuff. And the ways in which Black people get talked about, especially after the Moynihan Report in the 1960s, where Black mothers are always vilified if they're single mothers, or they don't have fathers, or you don't have a whole family unit, so therefore you're not really what we need to be. And so there's this aspirational kind of aspect to evangelicalism that brings all the rest of the people culturally in, because you want to be like that, you know, whole family, and you might not be, right? Yeah. But you get vilified for it at the same time. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's this way in which everything posits white evangelical Christianity Americanized, right? And so I could go to some place, I'll tell this quick story really quick, is that how do I notice existence in other places? When I went to Nigeria in 2018, I talked to a pastor. He is like, aren't you glad that Donald Trump got elected president? I said, excuse me? And black pastor now that Nigeria. And he said, oh yes. He said, if you had had Hillary Clinton, you would just have tons of abortions. But that Donald Trump was elected and God brought him to your country, that means your country is going to be saved. And this is wonderful. And we support him. And I said to him, but excuse me, Donald Trump said Nigeria was a shithole country. And he said, oh yeah, it is. But you know, but Donald Trump. And I'm like, wow.
Wow.
This is how it gets into you, right? And here's somebody in Nigeria, and Nigerians really support, a lot of Nigerians supported Donald Trump, but they supported this idea of Donald Trump being this kind of family man and being rich. And you gotta think about evangelicalism is not just, you know, is the racism is a feature, not a bug, but it's also not just the racism, but it's the idea of capitalism, the idea of power, and the idea that they can give you a foundational world that you can function in, that you won't have any problems if you just believe this stuff.
There's a precipice you talk about, right? Mm-hmm. Upon which, or that we're arriving at for the movement. What do you see as the possibilities for moving forward? In particular, what I'm wondering is, can this movement be redeemed? Can it be emptied of its racism? Or do we have to reimagine another movement that takes on some of the religious tenets, but disconnects from those political ones? But of course, the question might be, is that worthwhile? Not just is it savable, but should it be?
I'm not sure it's savable in its present form. And the reason why I say that has a lot to do with January 6th and the insurrection, because, you know, a lot of the people who were there were also evangelicals and Christian nationalists. And so what evangelicals have been desperately trying to do the last few months is untie themselves from Christian nationalism. I'm like, y'all the original Christian nationalists. You ain't untying yourself from this, okay?
Right.
This is who you are. And so when I talk about that precipice, that I wrote that last summer. That was the end of the book I was writing at the beginning of the summer. And I said that they were at a precipice because things had gotten so bad. They are, you know, basically all in bed with Trump. At the time, they were starting to really believe in Q and all of these conspiracy theories. And I could see the Christian nationalism. January 6th pushed them over the precipice. I think they're over now. And, okay. And the reason why they're over is not only is it all of that, but they're also basically an existential threat to the nation. And it's not just because of their religious beliefs. They won't get vaccinated. I mean, it's like everything that they do right now is antithetical to what the Jesus that they claim to believe in said, you know, take care of your fellow man, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They are definitely about tearing apart the social fabric of the nation to make it their fabric. And so in that light of thinking about this, I think they're already over the precipice. What's the hope for the movement? Many of them believe, you know, QAnon stuff. Many of them, you know, believe Trump when he said he won the election and he didn't win the election. Many of them won't get vaccinated. So I think some of them going to die. Some of them are going, you know, are going to lose themselves in the midst of all of this. And some of them, unfortunately, are locked up in jail right now because they stormed the Capitol.
Stormed the Capitol. Okay. They tried to overthrow the government, right?
Yeah. They tried to overthrow the government. But see, here's the problem for us. There's more of them. And some more of them might come to try to overthrow the government again because they're militia members. Some of them are cops. They're killing black folks. I mean, I could go on and on. It's a problem. And they're a big lobbyist group.
So I got to ask you, how does somebody with this level of analysis of the evangelicals end up at Fuller Seminary in the 90s?
Well, that's how I got this. The analysis was ended up at an evangelical seminary. You know, I was a nice little Christian girl back then. I wanted to be a Christian counselor. And I started to see how painful the story was. In fact, it really probably the origins of this book begin in the story I tell in the book about what happened after the 1992 uprising, or as they would have called it, the riots, right? And I lived in LA then, and that was a really troubled time. But I began to see the ways in which evangelicals talked about Black pain and the pain of all the people there that could see those cops get off from Rodney King. And so they were like, well, you know, the cops were right and this is bad, but we need to heal and move forward. And they were just willing to move forward when, in fact, we had all seen this videotape of Rodney King getting the crap beat out of him by these cops. you know? And then the stuff that happened in LA, they were like, well, this is terrible. I mean, we have played this tableau out over and over again, right? And right here in Philadelphia, where we both live. And I think that one of the things that really troubled me beginning then, and even when I went to seminary, was that there was a sense in which Black people's pain and the stuff that they endured, even though that they were Christians, was not being taken seriously by this larger group of people who claimed to say that they saw us as brothers and sisters, but at the same time kind of relegated us to this back seat of, you know, political organizing and things like that.
How challenging is it as a writer to write about matters of faith? I mean, there's a way that, you know, when you unpack politics, people will have their positions, but they respect your right to have a different one. But you sometimes are engaging in issues that are tied to people's perception of their humanity, their souls, their fate, their destiny, their traditions. Is it harder as an academic and as a popular writer now to write about faith in public?
I'm just hard-headed, I think. It's harder to write about it in one way, because what invariably ends up happening, and I want to commend you for not doing this, is that people want to talk to me about scripture about this book. I'm like, this is not what this book is about. Right. If you read this book this way about faith and everything else, you're actually reading it in not the way that I intended it to be read. I intended it to be read as, look at what these people's beliefs have brought us in the American public political sphere. What have they done? How have they gained power through this idea about morality that they snookered all of you with? That's what I'm really trying to say. But what makes it hard is that if I insert my story, there are people who said at the beginning of this when they read it, oh, you were really hurt by this or whatever. I'm like, well, I don't think I could write in the tone that I write. If I was really hurt, I'd still be licking my wounds and trying to find a church to help me. I'm not looking for that. What I'm looking for is I want to break down this construction. I want to make sure that people who have been hurt by this or don't understand our political system today understand that this is an existential threat to the nation and to us. And yes, it is a religious movement. Yes, people can have faith. But I also think that people need to understand how their faith gets used in political ways that they may not realize. And I think evangelicalism is a big way to show that.
Do you identify as a writer?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And I do because it's like, if people would ask me, where do I feel most comfortable at? I do feel more comfortable writing than I do anything else, because I think it's a way where my voice and my writing match up. So I think, I hope anyway, that when people read this book, they can also hear me talking through it, you know, because that's who I am. I think that way. And it's much more comfortable for me, believe it or not, to be writing than it is to be out in public. You know, public is one thing, because public, see, people see my face and they think certain kinds of things, right? But when I write, I can just be writing and go like, I'm going to cut through this, you know, because I know if I was a dude, y'all would be like, oh, wow, that's really great. Right. But a woman writing very strongly is always fearful for lots of people, right? So I like that I can write. I like that a lot. I also think that the hardest thing about being a religious studies professor and somebody who writes about religion is that people invariably think that it's all about your personal belief. And I'm like, no, it's not. Right. It's about, you know, an analytical way to see this. And so people need to understand that this is a really well-researched book. I'm not sitting up here trying to, you know, give anybody opinion. This is not an opinion piece. Basically, it's like what they say on Twitter, this you.
Right.
And so that's what I'm saying to evangelicals. This you, this is you, right? Because I just want you to remember that this is you. So I think that the writing process for me is a process of, you know, sitting back and thinking about stuff. This actually came out of an op-ed that I wrote back in 2019 from MSNBC Think. And my editor at UNC read it and said, this could probably be a book. And I'm like, you're right. It probably could be. And I sat down and blocked it out and did the proposal for it. And that proposal was accepted. And so I want everybody to understand how fast this went. It was accepted in December 2019. I had started sketching it out and I basically wrote it. I had coronavirus in March, right, when everything got started, because I had been traveling. And then I took a month to recuperate and the book was finished by the end of July.
That is an impressive timetable, especially for university press. I mean, you know, for University of North Carolina, which is obviously, for those that don't know, has a very long and deep history of publishing extraordinary books in the field of history, especially. And the way that you're able to meticulously kind of chart this history of American evangelicalism is of the highest academic standards, but you also made it very accessible.
Yeah.
How important is that to you?
very important, because this was a story that, you know, people are like, somebody read on what they said, where are the footnotes? And I'm like, the footnotes are in my head. I tell you everything in the text. I mean, if you want to go back and fact check me, you can fact check me, because it's pretty easy to do that. But, you know, I've been teaching a class on religion and politics off and on for almost 20 years. So I had most of the history stuff in my head. It's just that I could consolidate it in a certain kind of way and make it readable for people. I did not want this to be a 700-page tome. Ain't nobody reading that anymore. Nobody is reading this. But this is a book that you can take and give to somebody, or, you know, or talk to about with someone and say, I learned this about Billy Graham, or I learned this about Paul Weyrich saying, I don't want people to vote. There are little snippets you can take out of this and have a big conversation with it. And I made it an easy read because I wanted people to read it. I think that a lot of these books that we write right now are books that are not accessible, or they're poorly written and they don't hit where they need to hit. And I thought that this was a book that could hit and withstand the test of time. Like, you could pick this book up 10 years from now. And the fact that I didn't include Trump is actually really important, because it's a history book. And right. I think history needs to be accessible.
What's your writing process like? I know you said you wrote this one relatively quickly, but in general, what's your process like?
Sometimes I read a lot. For this book, this was really interesting because basically it's like, get up in the morning, get a cup of coffee, keep my pajamas on, and get to work. Sometimes, I mean, for difficult parts of the book, I don't know what it's like for other writers. I don't type very well sometimes. And so sometimes I have to start writing out longhand to get into my thought process. And then sometimes I outline. I know for people, sometimes people make very detailed outlines about when they write. I don't. I make a sketch and I kind of know the arc. And then, you know, like that piece that racism is a feature, not a bug of American evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Sometimes a phrase will come to me and I write down the phrases, because those are phrases that usually help lock me into certain kinds of things. And in this particular book, I had to think about what time period, right? So I'm going from like 1800 to about like right around 1920. Then I decided I would skip over. I didn't put the Scopes trial for different kinds of reasons. You have to think about what's going to be messy. And so you map out your time frame. You map out, you know, your people. Characters are really important. You know, in this particular book, there are certain characters that stand out, like Billy Graham or Paul Weyrich or, you know, Jerry Falwell or Barack Obama, that you know you got to include, right?
Right.
And so you got to give them the right amount of time. And then I also think that the other part of it is that I'm not, you know, some people like to share their stuff with everybody else, but I had my advisor at Vanderbilt, Lewis Baldwin, was always like, somebody stole my stuff and I don't ever share my things with anybody. And I'm like, yeah.
I remember as a grad student, I worked on a paper with a postdoc and I wrote my section. Other people wrote their sections. We put it together and he submitted. He said it didn't get accepted. I didn't think anything else of it. And then one day we were working in the same research center, and I remember going to the printer and he was printing out a paper. This is maybe months later that he was printing out for another publication. And just by chance, I picked it up and I saw my work in it. And I was like, oh, he just stole like a whole page or two of mine. It wasn't anything I was particularly committed to. I was a grad student. But at that moment, I realized that people steal work.
Yes.
And have no shame about it. Because he didn't think nothing else of it. And he went on to have a very good career. He's a prominent scholar, or the chair, endowed chair, full professorship, all that stuff. And it's always made me skeptical. So when I share writing, I share it with a very small group of people. I'm talking about two or three people. And most of them don't write in my area. Mm-hmm. So even if they stole it, they wouldn't do nothing with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's made me very, very wary about that. Do you have a community of people that you can bounce stuff with?
Yeah, I share with my editor at the press, obviously. I trust one of my grad students, I trust implicitly, I shared this with, who read it with me. Because, you know, he's working on part of this same subject, but in a very different way. And I trust him, and I knew he wouldn't, you know, because he got to get out of school.
Right. Right. You gonna see it, right.
I'm like, you got to get out. And, you know, so there's that. And he also knew my other big plagiarism story, how my dissertation got plagiarized by somebody. So I have one of those stories too.
Really?
Oh, really? It's 75 pages of it, child.
Oh, Lord.
That person is at a Southern university, which we will not name. And you know, yeah.
Wow.
And that was rough. So I know that feeling that you're talking about. But actually, there is somebody that I work with really closely, and that's been the editor who worked with me on my first book, because I had an outside editor to kind of just check my grammar, my spelling and everything. And she was really good as a person who could just ask me questions, like your friend who said, you know, what's this? And I actually think that that's one of the most important things about being a writer, because I'm not a clean writer. I get a lot of stuff down. The ideas are there and everything else, but you know, grammar, sometimes you get your stuff mixed up, but it's always good to have somebody look at your stuff and clean it up before you send it out. And she acts as that person for me. And that's been a really important person for me personally.
That's important for the audience here to hear. You know, Coffee and Books, we talk as much about process as we do about content. And for a lot of people, they see Ivy League professor that, she must get to the keyboard already looking like polished, you know. No. And it's like, sometimes we get to the keyboard real raggedy. And sometimes somebody got to get us together. The ideas might be there, but the writing might. Sometimes, you know, we need organization. Sometimes it's syntax. Sometimes it's grammar. Everybody comes to the keyboard with a different set of talents and skills. And it's a process. And it's the process of rewriting and redrafting that gets us to the end result. So I don't want y'all to be intimidated by this. In fact, you should be empowered by this, right? The idea that no matter where you start, if you have the ideas and the skill, you can hone the craft and you pull in editors and readers and other things to help get you across that finish line. Everybody does it. It's just a question of how they do it. Before you go, there's a little game I like to play with my guests. Mm-hmm. It's a game that brings them great torture, but it brings me great joy. So we gonna do it. You ready? It's called Buy It, Borrow It, or Burn It. And there are three books I'm going to give you. Mm-hmm. One you can buy, one you can borrow, one you got to burn.
Okay.
I'm going to name all three, and you tell me which one you're going to buy, which one you're going to borrow, which one you're going to burn, and you got to tell me why. Book number one, God of the Oppressed by James Cone. Book number two, Slave Religion by Albert Rabiteau. And book number three, Prophesied Deliverance by Cornel West.
Ooh, this is really hard.
That's the joy.
I'm in trouble for this one.
And I'm telling whoever you burn.
Damn. Okay, I'm going to start this backwards.
Okay.
And I'm doing this for a reason. I can't believe I'm going to actually say this, but he's not here with us anymore, so he can't hurt me. I'm going to burn God of the Oppressed. Burn God of the Oppressed. And there's a reason why I'm going to burn God of the Oppressed, because I've used it so much, I don't need it anymore.
That's fair. Okay.
I've used it enough.
I like that strategy.
I'm going to borrow Prophesied Deliverance because I always tell people to read chapter 2 in there, The Genealogy of Modern Racism.
Yes.
Which is a really important chapter if you go understand why we are where we are.
Yeah.
Read that chapter. And I'm going to always buy Slave Religion by Al Rabiteau because that's, for me, the foundation of all of my work in AFAM religious history. And I probably got 3 copies of it already.
I got about 2 in this office right here.
It's so funny you asked me that because, you know, this is a preview for the next piece I will have that's a very big piece out. I'm in the 1619 Project book, and I write a lot about Cone in there. So I could say I can burn Cone because I'm not really burning Cone.
Right.
I'm giving Cone a prominent piece in this particular essay that I will have in the book on the Black church. So.
And of course, everybody, we love all these books. It's just a torturous game that makes it a little bit of fun.
It is a torturous game.
So for those that don't know, Slave Religion is, would you call it a definitive?
Definitive. I mean, and definitive in the ways in which, you know, to think about the connections between Africa, African religions in the Americas. And we've had some great books since then, but this was the first defining book that people still use in class to talk about, you know, the connections between, you know, African derived religions and slave religions in the Americas, and to talk about the setup between the visible and the visible church, which is like the Black church, AME, Baptist, whatever, and the invisible church of slavery, and the invisible institution of how religion worked for the enslaved.
And Prophesied Deliverance by Cornel West, I would argue his most significant book. I know Race Matters is the most significant sort of public work, but his most significant scholarly work is probably Prophesied Deliverance. And in many ways, it is itself another foundational text of African-American religious studies. And for those of us who aren't religious scholars, there's so much in that book.
Yeah.
Every chapter is really a tour de force. But how important is Prophesied Deliverance to you?
Prophesied Deliverance was really important to me because I read it in grad school. You know, by then it had already been out like 10 years or whatever. But when I actually read that in seminary. And to read that Genealogy of Modern Racism in seminary is actually probably one of those moments in which all of this stuff started clicking together. In little ways, at least, not in the ways in which it has now, about evangelicalism and racism and understanding how the Enlightenment really brought about modern racism, for me, is key. I can't even remember the rest of the book because I think about that chapter so much.
Right.
And I usually still assign it in class because it's a way in which you have to understand this is the jig, you know, And before this, it's a certain kind of way of thinking about race. But after this is another kind of way of thinking about race. And this helps to make Black people oppressed throughout the world.
Absolutely. And for me, the New Cultural Politics of Difference as a chapter is one of those essays that you can give to students in almost any field, any discipline, any area to really understand how America emerges as the American Racial Project emerges. And I mean, there's so much you can do with that. And so, yeah, y'all got to read that. And lastly, God of the Oppressed, which is an interesting book to think about in relation to the work that you're talking about right now, because it's the foundation of liberation theology, a foundational text in liberation theology. How would you describe it?
I would say that God is on the side of the oppressed. God is not just here for the rich and the famous and all this other stuff, but God is working on the side of those who are for liberation and coming against all these societal structures of racism and, you know, sexism and all of these different kinds of things. You know, Cone's work, you know, this work in constructing Black theology is really important. So where I say I would burn it, he would probably say that I hope you burn it and throw it in somebody's place to set it on fire.
right. Burn down these institutions.
Yeah, exactly. Burn down these institutions. So if I was using that book on fire and throwing it someplace, he'd be really happy with that.
There you go. So three great books. Y'all should check them out. You can check these books out all at bookshop.org/shop/UncleBobby's or go to UncleBobby's.com. That's my favorite bookstore for obvious reasons. But the book today that we talk about is White Evangelical Racism by Anthea Butler. It is a powerful book. It is an amazing book. And it's a major contribution to the political conversation, but also the religious studies conversation. And we need to have all that stuff at the same time.
Yes.
How can people get a hold of you?
They can get hold of me on Twitter at Anthea Butler, just very simple. You can go to my website, AntheaButler.com. I'm on Facebook as Professor Anthea Butler, or you just look up Anthea Butler, it should come up. And you can get a hold of me at Penn. If you just put in Penn and Anthea Butler, you'll see me, and you can write me emails there. Or you can write me through my website.
All right. Well, it's good to see you. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarni Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.